Chapter 7. The Manipulation of Social Media. The fifth way the global media is controlling the narrative to control our minds is with social media. You see, newspapers, radio, music, books, the education system, and television are not the only subliminal manipulative technologies being used on us on a global basis by a small group of aliens, I mean rich elites around the world. Believe it or not, the recent trend of social media is as well. It too is out there swaying our minds subconsciously, telling us to buy and consume and even instruct our minds to go back to sleep, never question authority, obey and believe whatever these rich elitists want us to believe, including the need to scoff at the things of God. So, let's keep those glasses on one more time and see how this next media technology called social media is being used to manipulate the minds of the masses on a huge global scale. And not so surprisingly, just like all the other forms of media we've been examining, this manipulation that's being done, as we speak, with social media, has been going on, pretty much since its inception, whether people realize it or not. Let's see to how it all began.
It's hard to imagine a world without social media. In today's society, we use social media for a variety of purposes: to make new friends, keep up with celebrities and brands, to promote ourselves, express our thoughts and opinions to the world, or to stay in contact with friends and family who we do not often see, especially those who live a long way away. Social media has only been around for about 2 decades. Before that, methods of staying in contact with friends and loved ones over long distances away were not merely as simple. Let's take a look back at some of the earlier methods of communication, starting all the way back in 550 BC. Written correspondence delivered by hand from one person to another was the earliest method of communicating over long distances. The earliest postal system was created in 550 BC in ancient Persia. The Persian king Cyrus the Great mandated that every province in his kingdom would organize the delivery of posts to all of its citizens. Several other postal systems were introduced in many other countries following the Persian system. However, Rome established the first well-documented postal service. Organized at the time of Augustus Caesar, mail was delivered by light carriages pulled by horses. This service was created for government correspondence, but another service for citizens was later added. Over many centuries, postal delivery systems became much more widespread and organized. These systems are still widely used today, but thanks to technological advancements, there are other faster ways to communicate with loved ones over long distances. The telegraph was developed in the 1830s and 40s, and the first telegram was sent in 1844 by Samuel Morse, who is also known for his invention of Morse code. The telegraph allowed messages to be delivered over long distances much faster than through a postal system. Telegraphic messages had to be kept very short, but they were the fastest means of long-distance communication at the time and were one of the most significant advancements in communication technology that had occurred in centuries. In 1876, Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. Telephones were a revolutionary technology. They allowed people to communicate across long distances instantaneously, which had never been the case before. In the 20th century, technology began to advance at a rapid pace. The first supercomputers were created in the 1940s, and then as technology developed, engineers began to create networks between computers. Personal computers made their first appearance in the 1970s and continued to develop further with advancing technologies. It was J.C.R. Licklider who wrote one of the first descriptions of what would later become the Internet, a network of such computers, connected to one another by wideband communication lines, which provided the functions of present-day libraries together with anticipated advances in information storage and retrieval and other symbiotic functions. J.C.R. Licklider, Man-Computer Symbiosis, 1960. Licklider began development for one of the computer networks in the internal network for the United States Department of Defense called ARPANET, the first network link established in 1969. Several other networks followed, including Usenet, which allowed users to communicate through a virtual newsletter. In 1978, the first email system was developed, which allowed people to send and receive messages of text instantly. The main difference between the telephone and email in terms of long-distance communication is that with the telephone, both parties had to be available at the same time, whereas email messages did not need both sender and receiver to be available in order to work. They could each read and send messages when they had access or when it was convenient for them. The system that would become the Internet emerged in the late 1970s, and its initial purpose was to connect all the various networks that had been created and unify them. In the late 1980s, the first internet service provider companies were created, and the internet was first opened up to non-government use. Every day, America Online is making it easier for people to live, work and play.
As his friend is sitting at the computer, his friend asks him,
"Hey, Dan, ready for the game?"
"I'm just finishing up here with my new kayaking friends." Dan asks his friend, "Kayaking friends on your computer?"
His friend answers, "Yeah, I just got America Online." The World Wide Web was invented in 1989 by Tim Berners-Lee, who also created the first web browser called World Wide Web. Until social media came along, the internet was mainly used for mailing lists, emails, e-commerce, online forums and personal websites.
TechWiki.
People were already sharing content online through Flora, Chatroom, and Tripod Pages.
But what was the first site that used the modern paradigm of creating profiles and sharing different kinds of information with a subset of sites of users that you were connected with somehow?
A number of sites could try to claim that title, but a strong candidate was 6degrees, which entered the scene in 1997.
It featured plenty of elements that are now staples of social media, such as friends list and instant messaging.
But unfortunately, they closed their digital doors in 2001 because this is basically the quintessential example of something being too far ahead of its time. There just weren't enough people on the internet back then to keep the site afloat.
It wouldn't be until 5 years after 6degrees was born that the first social networking service hit a million users.
Friendster, launched in 2002, quickly became widely popular by showing users not only how they were connected to others but with a slicker presentation, similar to online dating sites of the time.
And they also benefited from the shrinking stigma around meeting people online due to the internet's explosive growth. But while Friendster quickly boasted a user base of over 3 million people, tough competition was on the horizon.
If you are around the same age as I am, 31 years old, you probably fondly remember, or at least remember, MySpace.
MySpace took a great deal of inspiration from Friendster.
But because the folks behind MySpace already ran a company called eUniverse, which operated multiple websites, like gaming and dating, MySpace had the advantage of being able to get the word out through eUniverse's existing user base.
This helped them to rapidly become more popular than Friendster.
In fact, Friendster's founder claimed that MySpace employees made posts on Friendster forums asking visitors to come join MySpace instead.
MySpace was also able to develop new features for their site faster than Friendster.
Meaning, for a while, that the internet was awash in profile pages featuring strange backgrounds and weird sparkling GIFs. And real life was awash in novelty t-shirts directing onlookers to said pages, "Yes, I'm on MySpace." Of course, MySpace's dominance was also short-lived thanks to a famous Harvard dropout. Mark Zuckerberg developed Facebook as a sophomore in 2004. He originally intended it to be a campus-wide student directory.
Apparently, because he was simply unhappy that it was 2004 and the university still hadn't created one.
After over 1,000 Harvard students registered to the site the first day, Facebook started expanding to other schools, requiring university or college email address in order to sign up. By the fall of 2005, most universities in the US had access to the site. Its explosive growth fueled by the ease with which the students could see who they were connected to through classmates that they already knew. This early version of Facebook lacked modern features, acting as a digital replacement for university directories with much more emphasis on showing background information through user profiles.
And the only way that visitors had of submitting anything to another user's page was by changing the wall. A block of text that any user's friends could edit at will.
Early on, Facebook didn't have the same pull as MySpace with advertisers, but changed once Facebook opened itself up to the masses in 2006.
For better or for worse, Facebook quickly dwarfed MySpace. The most prominent reason for this being the two sites diverged in terms of their functionality.
Facebook's model was focused much more heavily on the user-generated content and ways to make the networking part of social networking easier: pages, groups, and content sharing. MySpace, meanwhile, was widely considered to have spread itself too slim with extraneous features like karaoke that didn't work very well and a design that was quickly becoming clunky, slow, and outdated. MySpace also served their users with tons of ads and became susceptible to spam and malware. Facebook was regarded as much better maintained with a cleaner design and a very obvious influence on other social networks like VK in Russia and RenRen.com in China. So, in 2009, MySpace laid off 600 workers and after a couple of sales, it is still around but as a music-centered platform that is no longer trying to compete as a big-time do-it-all social media service. Meanwhile, while Facebook and MySpace were grappling for social networking dominance, Twitter tripped onto the scene in late 2006. And although the social media space was already becoming crowded, Twitter stood out because it wasn't a copycat site. Instead of focusing on user profiles and a huge set of social networking features, it was based on a much simpler idea. 140 characters, micro-logging posts or tweets, that could be used to reach everyone on the site instantly. This simplicity made it popular with convention-goers at the 2007 edition of South by Southwest, leading to some serious publicity and an explosion in usage going from 20,000 tweets per day, before the convention to 50 million in 2010, and of course the introduction of the often misused hashtag in 2007. Which Twitter turned into hyperlinks in 2009 and started to use to determine what topics are trending in 2010. It was this addition of trending to Twitter and later on Facebook that represented the next big trend on the major social networking sites.
With many turning at this point to trending topics and their customizable feeds instead of traditional media to get their breaking news.
This drew in the extra advertising dollars that have allowed services like Facebook and Twitter to expand into areas like live broadcasting and embedding richer forms of media directly into the posts. The fact that the way that we interact with each other on these social media sites has become mainstream means that we actually have even seen these social features of one kind or another implemented on other sites. Like how LinkedIn, a business networking site which has actually been around since 2002, now looks decidedly Facebook-like. Trending and community functions have shown up on YouTube, hashtags are on Instagram, now a Facebook subsidiary, and Reddit has a vote-based system which is roughly analogous to likes on other platforms. Today there are a huge variety of social media sites for various purposes, however the main purpose of social media continues to be connection to friends, family and strangers. For many, social media is a way to stay in touch with lifelong friends and keep up with family who live in other states or countries and to share photos, videos, news, thoughts and opinions or even just to send a quick message to say hello.
As well as allow these aliens, I mean rich elites, to manipulate the minds of the masses on a scale never before dreamed of. And if you don't think that's what they're doing with social media around the planet, let's look at just one of them, that of Facebook. From its inception, Facebook was designed not merely for the users to share information, but rather to acquire information on the user themselves. Don't believe me? Let's see just where Mark Zuckerberg got his seed money to launch Facebook in the first place.
Do you have a Facebook? Have you thought about the privacy you put at risk? Facebook allows users to post their favorite music, books, movies, their address, hometown, phone number, email, clubs, jobs, educational history, birth dates, sexual orientation, interests, daily schedules, exactly how they are related to friends, upload pictures of themselves and even political affiliations. Its privacy policy even goes so far as to state it also collects information about you from other sources, such as newspapers and instant messaging services. This information is gathered regardless of your use of the website. Have you seen the Facebook's Pulse feature? Pulse provides statistical trends among universities down to minuet details, such as percentages of females with conservative views, the student body's top 10 movies, and the percentage of students who have read Catcher in the Rye. The so-called privacy policy goes on to say that they share your information with third parties, including responsible companies of which they have a relationship. Can you think of any marketing group who could pass up such valid yet easily collected statistics such as these and others? So maybe they're using us. But is there more? Funding came in the form of $12.7 million from venture capital firm XL Partners. Sales manager James Breyer was former chair of the National Venture Capital Association. Breyer served as Venture Capital Association board with Gilman Louie, CEO of InQtel, a venture capital firm established by the Central Intelligence Agency in 1999. This firm works in various aspects of information technology and intelligence, including most notably nurturing data mining technologies. Breyer has also served on the board of BBN Technologies, as research and development firm known for spearheading the ARPANET, what we know today as the Internet. The EO, Information Awareness Office stated its mission was to gather as much information as possible about everyone. In a centralized location for easy perusal by the United States government, including but not limited to the internet activity, credit card purchase history, airline ticket purchases, car rentals, medical records, educational transcripts, driver's licenses, utility bills, tax returns, and any other available data. All of the above raises more questions than answers.
Yeah, I would say so. Boy, have we been duped. You just thought social media was for us to connect with other people. Silly rabbit, it's all about building huge, massive, mega databases on us to create a detailed psychological profile on each of us, on a global scale, not to mention also track our faces wherever we go. I mean, after all, they call it Facebook. Yes, your face is booked all right. It's in their databases tracking and building a massive global profile on you concerning your every move. Your likes, dislikes, contacts, interests, patterns of behavior, beliefs good, bad and ugly, you name it. It's all being stored, tracked, and monitored. And they're not the only ones. All major social media entities are also out there using their platforms to build huge, massive, mega global databases on us. And for those of you who need more proof of that, here you go. Again, let's just for now focus on the single social media entity called Facebook. But, keep in mind, they all do it.
Kieran Kittry, CNN reports. Well, if you or your friends post pictures of yourself drunk or other compromising positions on Facebook, you will want to hear this. A change to the company's fine print is raising questions online this morning about what happens to all the information that you post on your page. Alino Cho is following this story for us. First of all, you shouldn't post pictures of yourself in compromising positions anyway. But there is something interesting that has people scratching their heads. Apparently, a blogger found a checklist. Alino Cho. Essentially, we are talking about the TOS, Terms of Service, in respect to Facebook. It is probably something that most people who use Facebook have not heard about. About 2 weeks ago, the fine print explaining privacy rights on Facebook, quietly and subtly, changed. Here's what happened. Facebook removed language that said its ownership of your content would end when you remove that content or close your account. Now, what does that mean? It means that Facebook now would continue to have access to things like your personal photos and personal information. The blogs, as you might imagine, went crazy. The Consumerist, as published by Consumer Reports, responded by saying Facebook's new terms were tantamount to "we can do anything we want with your content, forever." Facebook can take all of the data that you submit and combine it with data from other users and outside information to construct a profile of you. Facebook uses nearly 100 different data points to classify your interests and activities. This would include basic stuff like your age and gender, but also more complicated information, like whether you own a motorcycle or you recently went on vacation or whether you are a gadget geek. Researchers have found that by using signals such as your likes or actions, Facebook can tell if you are in a relationship or going through a breakup. Facebook doesn't just know who you are, it also knows where you are, if you have location tracking turned on. Facebook collects an enormous amount of location data about where you are going, where you came from or where you live, where you work, restaurants and businesses you tend to go to, and they use this information to target ads at you, and location data can reveal other people who live in your house, even if you're not connected to them on Facebook. Now, obviously, Facebook knows what its users buy when they click on ads on Facebook. But what most people don't realize is that they have ways of tracking your offline purchases as well. For many years, Facebook has had partnerships with data brokers that collect information about people's purchases. So, for example, if you buy a burrito with your credit card, Facebook can know about that transaction, match it to the credit card that you added to Facebook or Facebook Messenger, and start showing you ads for indigestion medicine. One of the most controversial parts of Facebook data collection is a feature called People You May Know. This is where Facebook uses many different signals of what it knows about you to determine who else you might be connected to. And this is not always things you share with Facebook. It might be contacts in your phone, it might be people who have been in the same room as you. Facebook has been using location data to recommend friends. So, it might have been recommending people that shared a doctor with you, or work in the same building. Facebook can also be used to compile data about your political activity, like protests or marches you go to. In one case in 2016, the ACLU found that 500 police organizations had signed up for a service called GOPF, which scrapped data from social networks like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to help officers to look for users who might be in a specific location or attending a specific protest. Facebook doesn't just know who you are or where you are and what you buy, it also can be used to figure out what kinds of things you might do in the future to predict life outcomes, like whether you will be addicted to substances, whether you will switch political parties, whether you are physically healthy or physically unhealthy. Juju Chang, ABC News. Science fiction almost got it right. Face recognition technology has become part of daily life. But instead of controlling security access to top secret facilities, the technology is being used to identify the people in that crazy picture from last weekend's beach party. It's all happening, of course, on Facebook, which has been quietly using face recognition software on every photo you upload. An ABC reporter / Facebook user. Facebook knows me, it knows my friends, it tracks what I like, it knows where I live, it knows my sisters, Christy and Laura, but now Facebook also knows my face. My face out of everyone else's. Not just mine, but if you're on Facebook, Facebook can recognize your face too. Here's how. While we have been uploading nearly 20 billion photos, Facebook has been making file metric fingerprints of all our mugs. Now Facebook has a massive collection of our faces. Probably the largest collection in the world. Kind of cool, kind of creepy. Here's how it works. Intern Brenna Williams. I'm going to upload some photos of myself. ABC reporter / Facebook user. She is one of millions of people who are using this feature already. When she uploads photos, Facebook recognizes her and her friends and says, "Hey, that's you, right?" Most of the time it is, and tagging becomes almost automated. Face recognition technology has been around for a while. Mostly used by police. They even scan people walking into the Super Bowl and caught 19 criminals. The guys at face.com in Israel showed us how Facebook's technology works. They are the largest facial recognition company online. Once they had my photo, the computer recognized me, no matter where I was every time. This got us at Nightline thinking, could we trick Facebook? I tried one other way to confuse the computer. He put on a ball cap, large sunglasses, and a piece of tape on his upper lip. We sent that photo back to the guys at face.com and they recognized me even in my cover-up. Which goes to show that with that disguise you may fool your friends, but it probably won't fool Facebook. Fox 29 reports. Did you hear about this? Is Facebook playing another Big Brother? Some users are saying that the social media site is really crossing the line with their new messenger app. Joining us now is our new tech expert Anthony Mungaluzzo. Anthony, thanks for joining us. So many people are talking about this messenger app that used to be optional but now it's going to be mandatory, I guess. You have to download it. How does it all work and why are people worried about it? Anthony Mungaluzzo, tech expert. Well, basically, this new app is getting terrible reviews. It has a 1 out of 5 stars on the iPhone App Store and similar ratings on the Android. What this messenger app basically does is you have to give away all of your privacy. You allow Facebook to look at your call list, at your contacts, your text messages, it can even use your recording device and your camera device on your phone without even telling you. Fox 29 reports.
Okay, that's the thing that scared me the most.
Take me through that. I'm holding my phone right now. If I have this messenger app, they see what I see or even worse, spy on me with what I'm doing? Anthony Mungaluzzo. Most of your phone nowadays have two cameras, one in the front and one in the back, so legally you are giving them access to those cameras when you install that application. Fox 29 reports. So some creepy guy in the San Francisco Bay Area, someplace in Facebook, can be looking live at what I am looking at? Anthony Mungaluzzo. Don't just worry about San Francisco, Facebook is global, around the world, they can look at you. RT reports. What has Facebook been up to? Why does it even affect people not signed onto Facebook? Web developer and surveillance expert, Sander Venema, founder, Asteroid Interactive, joins me via Skype from the Netherlands. Sander, welcome back since going underground. So, what has Facebook done to trample over European privacy laws? Sander Venema. There was a report published by the Belgian Privacy Commission about Facebook's tracking behavior and more specifically the social plugins that they use. These are the like button and share buttons that see millions of websites across the internet, and these are loaded in from Facebook's domain name that basically places a cookie. Facebook places a cookie on your computer whenever those buttons are loaded in. RT reports. So if you press like or one of the like buttons, which doesn't even have to be on your Facebook site, it can be anywhere, it could be asking your ideology or your political persuasion, it all gets stored on your computer, and this is what the European regulators are worried about. Sander Venema. Actually, before you click like and when the like button is loaded in, so you load up the website, it has the like button on it before you even click on it, information went to Facebook, and then Facebook places the uniquely identified cookie on your computer, which they subsequently use on all of their other sites with Facebook like buttons to map the sites that you visit basically and map your interests.
And everything you could possibly be doing while you're online or on your phone. This is precisely why I call Facebook for what it is. It's not only Facebook, but it's Tracebook, because that's really what's going on here, folks. As you just saw. On the one hand, they're not hiding it. I mean, think about it. Social media accounts are called profiles, right? And that's exactly what they're doing. They're building huge, mega, massive global profiles on every aspect of our everyday lives, whether we realize it or not, of everything you can think of, what we are doing at any given moment. Including cataloging all of our friends, likes, dislikes, contacts, interests, patterns of behavior, beliefs, good, bad and ugly, you name it. It's all being cataloged and profiled. So that leads me to the next question, why? Why would social media entities be doing this to us? I mean, I thought it was just for having a fun and creative way to connect with people across the whole planet. I had no idea they were going to use it to connect me to their databases and profile every aspect of my life across the whole planet. Well, believe it or not, it's not only being done for the obvious monetary reasons, which are self-evident by the way. These aliens, I mean rich elites, are raking in billions, not millions, but billions of dollars every single year off of all this information they're gathering from us. In fact, here's the top 10 richest social media billionaires on the planet currently.
10. Heijin Lee, of Line, $1.7 billion. Reid Hoffman, of LinkedIn, $1.9 billion. Sean Parker, of Napster, $2.7 billion. Evan Spiegel, of Snapchat, $4.9 billion. Jack Dorsey, of Twitter, $8 billion. Yan Kom, of WhatsApp, $9.9 billion. Zhang Yiming, of ByteDance, $22.6 billion. Ma Weeding, of Tencent, $55.3 billion. Larry Page, of Google, $64.4 billion. Mark Zuckerberg, of Facebook, $92.9 billion.
So, as you can see, there are huge monetary reasons why these social media giants are gathering all this giant amount of information on us. They are raking in billions and billions of dollars every year off of it, through advertising, targeting advertising, buying, selling, subscriptions, services, fees, you name it. However, these global social media giants are not only using their media platforms for monetary reasons but also for monitoring reasons. You see, these aliens, I mean rich elites, are not dumb. They not only want to mesmerize the minds of the masses with all these various forms of global media we've been seeing throughout this documentary, but they also want to simultaneously know which of the masses around the world are not going to go along with their subliminal programming through these various forms of media. So, this is why they have devised a wicked scheme with social media that simultaneously not only allows them to rake in billions of dollars off of us, but to also literally catalog and profile any and all resistors who aren't going along with their brainwashing procedures through the media. Especially those who even have the audacity to put the glasses on and see and then even admit or even expose what these elitists are really up to on a global basis and then warn others of their nefarious plans. This monitoring and cataloging of any resistors is not only going on whether we realize it or not, but think of the manipulative irony going on here. We the individual who are being monitored by these social media companies to check for any resistors have also been tricked into volunteering this profiling information to them, on us, for free. Pretty slick, isn't it? But as you can see, with the advances of social media in the last couple of decades, it's not only become a major media staple to mold our minds and allow us to receive information in general. But just like newspapers, radio, music, books, the education system, and television, once this manipulative technology called social media sprang into existence, it too began to spread across the whole planet. And that's why today, the bulk of the planet is connected to all different kind of social media accounts, as this video shares.
In May of 1997, 6degrees was the first site to allow users to create profiles and friends lists. It was promoted as a tool to help people connect with and send messages to each other. 6degrees closed in 2000. Social media site Friendster launches in 2002. Membership peaked at 115 million users in 2008, then steadily declined until closing in June of 2015. Inspired spin-offs included Dogster and ELFester. MySpace, considered by many to be the first mainstream social media site, was acquired by News Corp in 2005 for $580 million. MySpace received more than 75 million visitors per month in late 2008. Initially open to Harvard students in 2004, then open to 800 colleges in May 2005. April 2008, Facebook's popularity overtakes MySpace's. In February 2009, the Like button debuts. Today, 68% of U.S. adults use Facebook. Corporate social networking site LinkedIn launched in 2003. In July 2011, LinkedIn became the number two site in the U.S., surpassing MySpace's 33.5 million visitors with 33.9 million. The first YouTube video was uploaded in April 2005, featuring co-founder Jawed Karim at the San Diego Zoo. Founded by three former employees of PayPal, the site has over 2 billion users, over one-third of all internet users. Every minute, more than 500 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube. Text-based social media service Twitter was born in 2006. Messages called tweets were limited to 140 characters each. In August 2007, the hashtag was introduced. Today, approximately 350,000 tweets are posted every minute. In 2010, Pinterest introduced unequal boxes, call pins, for sharing information. Tutorials, guides, and do-it-yourself pins have a 42% higher click rate versus all other types of pins. It is currently the fastest-growing website by overall member growth at 57%. Originally called Codename before launch, the first photo ever posted, a stray dog, was by the co-founder, at Kevin on July 16, 2010. A study found that 8% of all Instagram accounts are fake. The most Instagrammed food is pizza, in front of sushi and steak. Google Plus beta launched in 2011. After 2 weeks, more than 10 million users share around 1B items per day. The site shut down in April 2019 due to low user engagement. Pictures and messages sent are only accessible for a short time. Currently over 210 million active Snapchat users. 73% of U.S. users are 18 to 24 years old. In the U.S., 90% of all 13-24-year-olds use the app. More than 1 billion loops were played daily in 2015 on the video sharing service. If you flip the Vine logo, it reveals the number 6, the length of the videos on Vine. Vine is short for vignette, or a short impressionistic scene. The service shut down in January 2017, unable to keep up with competitor features. TikTok began in September of 2016. The video-sharing social network received 738 million downloads in 2019. TikTok has over 800 million active users worldwide. The second most popular free app download in 2019, behind WhatsApp. TikTok has the highest social engagement rates per post versus Instagram and Twitter.
Wow. 2.6 billion users on Facebook alone? That's a lot of global influence in the hands of just one alien, I mean rich elite around the whole planet. And now, nearly 4 billion people currently use social media worldwide, which is an overall increase in users of 92.76% in just 5 years. And the average person even has nearly 9 social media accounts. It's worse than a Lay's potato chip, apparently. You can't just have one. But as you can see, in all seriousness, the social media platforms are simply yet another fantastic leap forward of manipulative media technology if you want to connect to the world and mesmerize the minds of the masses for some nefarious purpose. And that's exactly what these elites are doing. Social media has now become a very important, and frankly, dependent tool to share information, educate, or even mold the minds of people either for good or bad. Therefore, once again, whoever controls the media of social media and all its various platforms, they have yet another powerful tool to manipulate the minds of the masses around the whole world. And believe it or not, that control of social media on a global basis is already here. Just like with newspapers, radio, music, books, the education system, television, so now even social media is in the hands of just a few aliens, I mean rich elites. You still seeing a pattern here? This has already been demonstrated with the top 10 social media owners that I shared with you, that are raking in billions of dollars off their social media platforms. They alone control the bulk of the planet's social media outlets. And just like all the other forms of global media, so too are these handful of elite social media owners using their global ownership of these platforms for their own evil manipulative purposes to regurgitate a pre-programmed, pre-scripted narrative for us to digest from them to literally program our minds and mesmerize the masses. Including the silencing of any dissenting opinion by people exercising their God-given rights to freedom of speech. Again, the pattern is exactly the same with all other forms of media. These aliens, I mean rich elites, know what they're doing. And that horrible truth came in the last election cycle when it was shown that these top social media owners and their various platforms were refusing any narrative than what they didn't want us to see or hear or even listen to involving the election process. In fact, they even silenced the President of the United States. I mean, who do they think they are? But this is what they did during and after the election.
Candace Owens, Facebook is trying to delete me. Big tech is trying to delete us, our movement. We must stop them. You're smart. Long ago, you stopped believing in the corrupt corporate media. You canceled the newspapers and cable shows and began reading your news from social platforms. Dominant on those platforms were conservative voices like mine. We are the Americans who did not have a voice in traditional media. Honestly, do you think the left wants me to have a platform to speak? But I can have a voice. Here on my own social platforms. On her cell phone, I can be heard. That freedom infuriates the left, who used to own complete control over our information. So, they hatched a plan to silence me, and all of us conservatives, and Facebook is paying them for it. Here is how it works. In 2016, hysterical liberals had to find someone to blame for their humiliating loss to Donald Trump. In their minds, they could not possibly have lost due to their own horrendous candidates or policies or their own failing message. So, they attacked the one thing that they did not have total control over, social media companies. They applied extreme pressure to silence or censor fake news, which was just a fancy way of saying news that they don't like. Facebook bent to that pressure and created a fact-checker network with godlike powers over all of us. Here is how Facebook fact-checking works. A website you have never heard of run by partisan beta leftists stalk the pages of your favorite conservative personalities. Whenever we say anything they disagree with, these fact-checkers write a vicious partisan hit piece. Then, they harass us and our audience by slapping hazardous warning labels on what we have posted. Many times, those labels say, missing context or disputed. Yes, thanks Facebook. Every political argument in America is disputed. Every argument is indeed missing some context, but the insanity continues. These hack-checkers, as I like to call them, would be just an annoyance, but Facebook give them the ability to destroy the reach of our content so we cannot communicate with you. They demonetize our pages so we can't make a living producing content for our audiences. And here's the breathtaking part. Most of the fact-checks are pure partisan bile. They're false, fake, untrue, but there is no recourse for your favorite conservative creators. We are held at gunpoint by these partisan hacks. And Facebook is giving them the gun. This is why I am suing the Facebook fact-checkers. I am suing them on behalf of you, your favorite creators and news sites on behalf of our freedom of speech and thought. So, who are these hack checkers? Well, I'm suing a site called Lead Stories. Lead Stories is run by a former CNN employee of 26 years, who makes a living cannibalizing and slandering conservative content and creators. His website has published disputed fake news stories, including one that went after my content personally. So, I'm going after him personally. Here's an important question. Who funds Lead Stories? According to their own masthead, Lead Stories is funded by Facebook and Google along with ByteDance. And what is ByteDance? It's a Beijing-based company that owns the TikTok spyware app. Our own Justice Department says the company is a national security threat and compromised by the Communist part of China. Facebook, then, is paying for fact-checkers funded by an arm of the Communist Party of China to censor my content here in America. The Communist Party of China has more say over my content than the First Amendment. This is insanity. It's un-American, it's dangerous, and it needs to stop. This is why I am fighting. Our freedoms are at stake. Our movement is at stake. We know these battles are taking place all over the world. Newscaster, this morning President Trump, waking up without his favorite megaphone. President Trump, let me ask you. Should I keep the Twitter going or not? Newscaster, Twitter permanently banning the Commander-in-Chief's personal account with 88 million followers. After an initial 12-hour lockout following Wednesday's riots at the U.S. Capitol. The company run by Jack Dorsey saying, after close review of recent tweets from the @RealDonaldTrump account and the context around them, we have permanently suspended the account due to the risk of further incitement of violence. With his legend of tweets simply gone, President Trump moved quickly to post on the official POTUS account, attacking Twitter, Democrats, and the radical left. Those tweets taken down within minutes. Twitter's actions sparking celebration and outrage. Senator Joe Manchin, thanking Twitter and Mark Warner, calling it an overdue step. But the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., was furious, sounding off, "Free speech no longer exists in America. It died with big tech, and what's left is only there for a chosen few." Trump's former UN ambassador Nikki Haley saying, "This is what happens in China, not our country." Man in America, 2020 has been a year like no other. Everything we know, everything we trust, and everything we come to rely on has changed. So how can we expect the US election to be any different? Mainstream media are telling us the race is over. Biden won. Time to move on. Nothing to see here, folks. But in your gut, you know something's just not right. From the strange patterns on election night to the weeks of suspense to the ports of fraud that evaporates faster than Biden's memory. It just doesn't add up. Stay with me, and you will see just what is going on behind the scenes in this election. And why the greatest threat we are facing right now is not the invisible enemy entering our bodies, but one that is invading our country and our minds. How do you know what is happening in the world right now? How do you know what is going on in this country? Or even your city? I'm going to go out on the limb here and say you probably turn to mainstream media, which means social media. Perhaps you watch Tucker in the evenings or read the New York Times Sunday morning. Or you check Facebook at lunch on your break. So how do you know what is going on in the US election? What did you think on election night when historically red states and battleground states were stalled while blue states were immediately called for Biden? Or when Fox called Arizona, with so many votes still out? Of course, for Biden. And how about the late-night ballot dumps that were somehow all for Biden? And the ballots that were pristine mail-in ballots that were all for Biden? Then there were the burst water pipes, and the power outages, and the computer glitches, and the issue of Sharpie pens, and lost USB drives, that somehow all favored Biden. Then we have the hordes of dead voters. Once again, all for Biden. The dead people really did vote for Biden, I fact-checked it. And what are the odds that all the last-minute changes to the election process and voting laws in the name of COVID also favored Biden? And how about all the counties with more votes than eligible voters, or where they got more mail-in ballots that they even sent out? In Pennsylvania, they sent out 1.8 million ballots and got back 2.5 million. And last but not least, we got Dominion, the voting system with ties to socialist Venezuela that was programmed to manipulate votes for Biden, while sending our data to China, Iran, and Russia. When the system crashed because of the Trump landslide, key battleground states simply decided to stop counting and head on home. When has this ever happened before in US history? This is just the tip of the iceberg. Every one of these reports should be serious grounds for investigation. Thousands of poll workers, postal workers, election officials, and honest Americans, both Republican and Democrat, have come forward with photos, videos, and first-hand stories, affirmed by sworn affidavits, documenting massive voter fraud. Social media had been flooded with them, yet mainstream media keeps asking, where's the evidence? Live, once everyone is gone, the coast is clear. They are going to pull ballots out from underneath a table. Watch this table. Do you see the gentleman in the red? He just pulled one out. He pulled a box of ballots out from under the table, so, what are these ballots doing there? Separate from all the other ballots? And why are they counting them when the place is cleared out? With no witnesses? Man in America, where is the evidence? Witness, I'm here with my friend, and we were taking the trash out and I wanted to show you guys what we found in the trash cans. He videos ballot after ballot that are all marked Donald Trump. There are more ballots in this trash bag and in the trash bin. But we will say, we did find one Biden. Man in America, where is the evidence? Rudy Giuliani, can you calculate out how many voted for Biden and how much for Trump? Colonel Phil Waldron, close to 600,000. I think our figures were about 570,000 some odd thousand, all those spikes represented over time. Rudy Giuliani, for Biden? And how much for Trump? Colonel Phil Waldron, I think it was a little over 3,200. Man in America, now hold on. Didn't they just drag us through a baseless four-year witch hunt in the Russian election interference over far less evidence, and isn't it their job to be digging for evidence? Wouldn't Nixon have gotten away with Watergate if the media didn't dig for evidence? Not only aren't they digging for it right now, but they are burying it in a giant game of whack-a-mole, along with their comrades over at Facebook, Twitter, and Google. Of course, they had their fact-checkers debunk everything first. These arbiters of truth, who have more confidence and interest in what flavors of ice cream in Nancy Pelosi's freezer. Even President Trump's tweets are so-called fact-checked and censored, and his press conferences are interrupted and cut off. As President Trump is speaking, the new commentator speaks or him making it impossible to understand what he is saying. News commentator, I am not only interrupting the President of the United States but correcting the President of the United States. Man in America, think about what this means. The President of the United States of America is being censored by U.S. companies. This whole thing reeks of corruption. Not just corruption, but treason. It is such a joke that I would be laughing if it wasn't so serious. But it is serious. Because let's assume for a moment that just a fraction of reports are true. If mainstream and social media didn't let you see or even talk about them, how would you even know? Think about it. If our election was stolen and our government was overthrown and yet they kept it all hidden, how would you know? If mainstream media can completely control public opinion and the flow of information, including from our president, does the truth even matter? What if I told you that every single one of our mainstream media, including Fox, is being used as a tool to manipulate public opinion and steer the outcome of the election? Perhaps a year ago you might have called me a conspiracy theorist, but considering that we have been living in the Twilight Zone lately, you are probably starting to realize that anything is possible. Just try to wrap your head around this. How did the media so accurately predict the long delays in counting votes, in the red mirage before the blue wave? And why did they spend months downplaying the risks of mail-in ballots while sowing the seed that Trump would claim voter fraud and refuse to concede? Do they have a crystal ball? Why did Hillary Clinton tell Biden not to concede under any circumstances, all the way back in the summer? Why did they spend for the last 4 years using every possible tactic to undermine President Trump's presidency? In the most relentless smear campaign that the world has ever seen. And why did every mainstream media rush to coronate Biden and cement him in the public mind? Now do you understand why he told voters, I don't need you to get me elected. It never mattered that he hid in his basement all summer. It never mattered that only 5 people turned out for his rallies. It didn't matter that he couldn't even string his sentence together. It didn't matter that the majority of Americans chose President Trump on November 3rd, because when you control every single channel of information, nothing else matters. Right now, big media, big tech, big government, and even celebrities are blanking us with the narrative that Biden won while censoring all evidence of fraud and concealing the very real truth that our nation has been facing its greatest threat since the American Revolution. Because as our founding fathers knew all too well, the moment we no longer have free speech and a free press to keep the government in check, we no longer have a democracy.
And that's exactly what's happened today from a handful of aliens, I mean rich elites who now own and control all the information and content on all the various global media platforms, including social media. Again, whatever happened to free speech, including for the President of the United States? Are you elites actually controlling the narrative of what people receive from all these various media outlets, including social media, to the point where you actually silence any dissenting view? Again, this is not news reporting, it's news determination. It's indoctrination and flat-out brainwashing even in the United States of America. Our founding fathers must be rolling over in their graves. In fact, let me give you just one more example of just how much the information that we are receiving from the internet, as well as social media, really is filtered and controlled by a handful of aliens, I mean rich elites. Let's take a look at another manipulative entity called Google. I mean, surely when we use their services, including their search engine online, we're getting the truth, right? Just the facts, right? Wrong. They are actually subliminally allowing us to only receive what they want us to receive. Here's just some of the proof.
Over the past century, more than a few great writers have expressed concern about humanity's future. In The Iron Heel, 1908, the American writer Jack London pictured a world in which a handful of wealthy corporate titans, the oligarchs, kept the masses at bay with a brutal combination of rewards and punishments. Much of humanity lived in virtual slavery, while the fortunate ones were bought off with decent wages that allowed them to live comfortably, but without any real control over their lives. In We, 1924, the brilliant Russian writer Yevgeny Zamatin, anticipating the excesses of the emerging Soviet Union, envisioned a world in which people were kept in check through pervasive monitoring. The walls of their homes were made of clear glass, so everything they did could be observed. They were allowed to lower their shades an hour a day to have sex, but both the rendezvous time and the lover had to be registered first with the state. In Brave New World, 1932, the British author Aldous Huxley pictured a near-perfect society in which unhappiness and aggression had been engineered out of humanity through a combination of genetic engineering and psychological conditioning. And in the much darker novel 1984, 1949, Huxley's compatriot George Orwell described a society in which thought itself was controlled. In Orwell's world, children were taught to use a simplified form of English called newspeak in order to assure that they could never express ideas that were dangerous to society. These are all fictional tales, to be sure, and in each the leaders who held the power used conspicuous forms of control that at least a few people actively resisted and occasionally overcame. But in the non-fiction bestseller The Hidden Persuaders, 1957, recently released in a 50th anniversary edition, the American journalist Vance Packard described a strange and rather exotic type of influence that was rapidly emerging in the United States and that was, in a way, more threatening than the fictional types of control pictured in the novels. According to Packard, U.S. corporate executives and politicians were beginning to use subtle and, in many cases, completely undetectable methods to change people's thinking, emotions and behavior based on insights from psychiatry and the social sciences. Most of us have heard of at least one of these methods, subliminal stimulation, or what Packard called sub-threshold effects, the presentation of short messages that tell us what to do but that are flashed so briefly we aren't aware we have seen them. In 1958, propelled by public concern about a theater in New Jersey that had supposedly hidden messages in a movie to increase ice cream sales, the National Association of Broadcasters, the association that set standards for U.S. television, amended its code to prohibit the use of subliminal messages in broadcasting. In 1974, the Federal Communications Commission opined that the use of such messages was contrary to the public interest. Legislation to prohibit subliminal messaging was also introduced in the U.S. Congress but never enacted. Both the UK and Australia have strict laws prohibiting it. Subliminal stimulation is probably still in wide use in the U.S., it's hard to detect, after all, and no one is keeping track of it. Packard had uncovered a much bigger problem, however, namely that powerful corporations were constantly looking for, and in many cases already applying, a wide variety of techniques for controlling people without their knowledge. He described a kind of cabal in which marketers worked closely with social scientists to determine, among other things, how to get people to buy things they didn't need and how to condition young children to be good consumers, inclinations that were explicitly nurtured and trained in Huxley's Brave New World. Guided by social science, marketers were quickly learning how to play upon people's insecurities, frailties, unconscious fears, aggressive feelings and sexual desires to alter their thinking, emotions and behavior without any awareness that they were being manipulated. By the early 1950s, Packard said, politicians had got the message and were beginning to merchandise themselves using the same subtle forces being used to sell soap. Packard prefaced his chapter on politics with an unsettling quote from the British economist Kenneth Boulding, "A world of unseen dictatorship is conceivable, still using the forms of democratic government. Could this really happen, and, if so, how would it work?" The forces that Packard described have become more pervasive over the decades. The soothing music we all hear overhead in supermarkets causes us to walk more slowly and buy more food, whether we need it or not. Most of the vacuous thoughts and intense feelings our teenagers experience from morning till night are carefully orchestrated by highly skilled marketing professionals working in our fashion and entertainment industries. Politicians work with a wide range of consultants who test every aspect of what the politicians do in order to sway voters: clothing, intonations, facial expressions, makeup, hairstyles and speeches are all optimized, just like the packaging of a breakfast cereal. But what would happen if new sources of control began to emerge that had little or no competition? And what if new means of control were developed that were far more powerful, and far more invisible than any that have existed in the past? And what if new types of control allowed a handful of people to exert enormous influence not just over the citizens of the US but over most of the people on Earth? It might surprise you to hear this, but these things have already happened. Google decides which web pages to include in search results, and how to rank them. How it does so is one of the best-kept secrets in the world, like the formula for Coca-Cola. To understand how the new forms of mind control work, we need to start by looking at the search engine one in particular, the biggest and best of them all, namely Google. The Google search engine is so good and so popular that the company's name is now a commonly used verb in languages around the world. To Google something is to look it up on the Google search engine, and that, in fact, is how most computer users worldwide get most of their information about just about everything these days. They Google it. Google has become the main gateway to virtually all knowledge, mainly because the search engine is so good at giving us exactly the information we are looking for, almost instantly and almost always in the first position of the list it shows us after we launch our search, the list of search results. That ordered list is so good, in fact, that about 50% of our clicks go to the top two items, and more than 90% of our clicks go to the 10 items listed on the first page of results. Few people look at other results pages, even though they often number in the thousands, which means they probably contain lots of good information. Google decides which of the billions of web pages it is going to include in our search results, and it also decides how to rank them. How it decides these things is a deep, dark secret, one of the best-kept secrets in the world, like the formula for Coca-Cola. Because people are far more likely to read and click on higher-ranked items, companies now spend billions of dollars every year trying to trick Google's search algorithm, the computer program that does the selecting and ranking, into boosting them another notch or two. Moving up a notch can mean the difference between success and failure for a business, and moving into the top slots can be the key to fat profits.
Again, there's your monetary manipulation to the tune of billions, or in this case fat profits. But do you see how the whole system is rigged and controlled whether you realized it or not? It's just another long line of subliminal seduction foisted upon us for various nefarious purposes by these global elites. In fact, it has now come out that Google has not only been guilty for a long time of subliminally censoring content for manipulative monetary purposes, but they and other social media platforms are also simultaneously blacklisting entities and people who are trying to share something contrary to what Google wants us to hear. Again, whatever happened to free speech? But check this proof out.
The new censorship. How did Google become the internet censor and master manipulator, blocking access to millions of websites? Google Incorporated isn't just the world's biggest purveyor of information, it is also the world's biggest censor. The company maintains at least 9 different blacklists that impact our lives, generally without input or authority from any outside advisory group, industry association, or government agency. Google is not the only company suppressing content on the internet. Reddit has frequently been accused of banning postings on specific topics, and a recent report suggests that Facebook has been deleting conservative news stories from its newsfeed, a practice that might have a significant effect on public opinion, even on voting. Google, though, is currently the biggest bully on the block. when Google's employees or algorithms decide to block our access to information about a news item, political candidate or business, opinions and votes can shift, reputations can be ruined, and businesses can crash and burn. Because online censorship is entirely unregulated at the moment, victims have little or no recourse when they have been harmed. Should we allow a large corporation to wield an especially destructive kind of power that should be exercised with great restraint and should belong only to the public, the power to shame or exclude? If Google were just another mom-and-pop shop with a sign saying, "We reserve the right to refuse service to anyone," that would be one thing. But as the golden gateway to all knowledge, Google has rapidly become an essential in people's lives, nearly as essential as air or water. We don't let public utilities make arbitrary and secretive decisions about denying people services. We shouldn't let Google do so either. Let's start with the most trivial blacklist and work our way up. I'll save the biggest and baddest, one the public knows virtually nothing about but that gives Google an almost obscene amount of power over our economic well-being, until last. 1. The autocomplete blacklist. This is a list of words and phrases that are excluded from the autocomplete feature in Google's search bar. The search bar instantly suggests multiple search options when you type words such as democracy or watermelon, but it freezes when you type other certain words. The autocomplete blacklist can also be used to protect or discredit political candidates. As recently reported, at the moment autocomplete shows you TED, for former GOP presidential candidate Ted Cruz, when you type lying, but it will not show you Hillary when you type crooked, not even, on my computer, anyway, when you type crooked hill. The nicknames for Clinton and Cruz coined by Donald Trump, of course. If you add the A, so you've got crooked Hiller, you get the very odd suggestion crooked Hillary Bernie. When you type crooked on Bing, crooked Hillary pops up instantly. Google's list of forbidden terms varies by region and individual. 2. The Google Maps blacklist. This list is a little creepier, especially if you are concerned about your privacy. The cameras of Google Earth and Google Maps have photographed your home for all to see. If you don't like that, just move, Google's former CEO Eric Schmidt said. Google also maintains a list of properties it either blacks out or blurs out in its images. Some are probably military installations, some the residences of wealthy people, and some, well, who knows? Martian pre-invasion enclaves? Google doesn't say. 3. The YouTube blacklist. YouTube, which is owned by Google, allows users to flag inappropriate videos, at which point Google censors weigh in and sometimes remove them, but not, according to a recent report by Gizmodo, with any great consistency except perhaps when it comes to politics. Consistent with the company's strong and open support for liberal political candidates, Google employees seem far more apt to ban politically conservative videos than liberal ones. In December 2015, singer Joyce Bartholomew sued YouTube for removing her openly pro-life music video. YouTube also sometimes acquiesces to the censorship demands of foreign governments. Most recently, in return for overturning a 3-year ban on YouTube in Pakistan, it agreed to allow Pakistan's government to determine which videos it can and cannot post. 4. The Google account blacklist. A couple of years ago, Google consolidated a number of its products: Gmail, Google Docs, Google Plus, YouTube, Google Wallet, and others, so you can access all of them through your one Google account. If you somehow violate Google's vague and intimidating terms of service agreement, you will join the ever-growing list of people who are shut out of their accounts, which means you'll lose access to all of these interconnected products. Because virtually no one has ever read this lengthy, legalistic agreement, however, people are shocked when they're shut out, in part because Google reserves the right to stop providing services to you at any time. And because Google, one of the largest and richest companies in the world, has no customer service department, getting reinstated can be difficult. 5. The Google News Blacklist. If a librarian were caught trashing all the liberal newspapers before people could read them, he or she might get in a heap of trouble. What happens when most of the librarians in the world have been replaced by a single company? Google is now the largest news aggregator in the world, tracking tens of thousands of news sources in more than 30 languages and recently adding thousands of small, local news sources to its inventory. It also selectively bans news sources as it pleases. In 2006, Google was accused of excluding conservative news sources that generated stories critical of Islam, and the company has also been accused of banning individual columnists and competing companies from its news feed. In December 2014, facing a new law in Spain that would have charged Google for scraping content from Spanish news sources, which, after all, have to pay to prepare their news, Google suddenly withdrew its news service from Spain, which led to an immediate drop in traffic to Spanish news stories. That drop in traffic is the problem. When a large aggregator bans you from its service, fewer people find your news stories, which means opinions will shift away from those you support. Selective blacklisting of news sources is a powerful way of promoting a political, religious, or moral agenda, with no one the wiser. 6. The Google AdWords blacklist. Now things get creepier. More than 70% of Google's $80 billion in annual revenue comes from its AdWords advertising service, which it implemented in 2000 by infringing on a similar system already patented by Overture Services. The way it works is simple. Businesses worldwide bid on the right to use certain keywords in short text ads that link to their websites. Those text ads are the AdWords. When people click on the links, those businesses pay Google. These ads appear on Google.com and other Google websites and are also interwoven into the content of more than a million non-Google websites Google's display network. The problem here is that if a Google executive decides your business or industry doesn't meet its moral standards, it bans you from AdWords. These days, with Google's reach so large, that can quickly put you out of business. 7. The Google AdSense blacklist. If your website has been approved by AdWords, you are eligible to sign up for Google AdSense, a system in which Google places ads for various products and services on your website. When people click on those ads, Google pays you. If you are good at driving traffic to your website, you can make millions of dollars a year running AdSense ads all without having any products or services of your own. Meanwhile, Google makes a net profit by charging the companies behind the ads for bringing them customers. This accounts for about 18% of Google's income. Here, too, there is scandal. In April 2014, in two posts on pastebin.com, someone claiming to be a former Google employee working in their AdSense department alleged the department engaged in a regular practice of dumping AdSense customers just before Google was scheduled to pay them, in some cases payments as high as $500,000. 8. The search engine blacklist. Google's ubiquitous search engine has indeed become the gateway to virtually all information, handling 90% of search in most countries. It dominates search because its index is so large. Google indexes more than 45 billion web pages. Its next biggest competitor, Microsoft's Bing, indexes a mere 14 billion, which helps to explain the poor quality of Bing's search results. Google's dominance in search is why businesses large and small live in constant fear of Google, as Matthias Döpfner, CEO of Axel Springer, the largest publishing conglomerate in Europe, put it in an open letter to Eric Schmidt in 2014. According to Döpfner, when Google made one of its frequent adjustments to its search algorithm, one of his company's subsidiaries dropped dramatically in the search rankings and lost 70% of its traffic within a few days. Even worse than the vagaries of the adjustments, however, are the dire consequences that follow when Google employees somehow conclude you have violated their guidelines. You either get banished to the rarely visited Netherlands of search pages beyond the first page, 90% of all clicks go to links on that first page, or completely removed from the index. Search ranking manipulations of this sort don't just ruin businesses, they also affect people's opinions, attitudes, beliefs and behavior, as my research on the search engine manipulation effect has demonstrated. This brings me, at last, to the biggest and potentially most dangerous of Google's blacklists, which Google calls its quarantine list. 9. The quarantine list. To get a sense of the scale of this list, I find it helpful to think about an old movie, the classic 1951 film The Day the Earth Stood Still, which starred a huge metal robot named Gort. He had laser weapon eyes, zapped terrified humans into oblivion and had the power to destroy the world. Klaatu, Gort's alien master, was trying to deliver an important message to Earthlings, but they kept shooting him before he could. Finally, to get the world's attention, Klaatu demonstrated the enormous power of the alien races he represented by shutting down, at noon New York time, all of the electricity on Earth for exactly 30 minutes. The Earth stood still. Substitute Ogle for RT, and you get Google, which is every bit as powerful as Gort so good, in fact, that you are probably unaware that on January 31, 2009, Google blocked access to virtually the entire internet. And, as if not to be outdone by a 1951 science fiction move, it did so for 40 minutes. Impossible, you say. Why would do no evil Google do such an apocalyptic thing, and, for that matter, how, technically, could a single company block access to more than 100 million websites? The answer has to do with the dark and murky world of website blacklists, ever-changing lists of websites that contain malicious software that might infect or damage people's computers. In 2012, Google acknowledged that each and every day it adds about 9,500 new websites to its quarantine list and displays malware warnings on the answers it gives to between 12 and 14 million search queries. It won't reveal the exact number of websites on the list, but it is certainly in the millions on any given day. In 2011, Google blocked an entire subdomain, co.cc, which alone contained 11 million websites, justifying its action by claiming that most of the websites in that domain appeared to be spammy. According to Matt Cutts, still the leader of Google's web spam team, the company reserves the right to take such action when it deems it necessary. The right? Who gave Google that right? And that's nothing, according to The Guardian, on Saturday, January 31, 2009, at 2:40 p.m. GMT, Google blocked the entire internet for those impressive 40 minutes, supposedly, said the company, because of human error by its employees. It would have been 6:40 a.m. in Mountain View, California, where Google is headquartered. Was this time chosen because it is one of the few hours of the week when all of the world's stock markets are closed? When Google's search engine shows you a search result for a site it has quarantined, you see warnings such as, the site ahead contains malware, or this site may harm your computer on the search result. That's useful information if that website actually contains malware, either because the website was set up by bad guys or because a legitimate site was infected with malware by hackers. But Google's crawlers often make mistakes, blacklisting websites that have merely been hijacked, which means the website itself isn't dangerous but merely that accessing it through the search engine will forward you to a malicious site. My own website was hijacked in this way in early 2012. Accessing the website directly wasn't dangerous but trying to access it through the Google search engine forwarded users to a malicious website in Nigeria. When this happens, Google not only warns you about the infected website on its search engine, which makes sense, it also blocks you from accessing the website directly through multiple browsers, even non-Google browsers. The mistakes are just one problem. The bigger problem is that even though it takes only a fraction of a second for a crawler to list you, after your site has been cleaned up, Google's crawlers sometimes take days or even weeks to delist you long enough to threaten the existence of some businesses. This is quite bizarre considering how rapidly automated online systems operate these days. Within seconds after you pay for a plane ticket online, your seat is booked, your credit card is charged, your receipt is displayed, and a confirmation email shows up in your inbox, a complex series of events involving multiple computers controlled by at least three or four separate companies. But when you inform Google's automated blacklist system that your website is now clean, you are simply advised to check back occasionally to see if any action has been taken. To get delisted after your website has been repaired, you either have to struggle with the company's online webmaster tools, which are far from friendly, or you have to hire a security expert to do so, typically for a fee ranging between $1,000 and $10,000. No expert, however, can speed up the mysterious delisting process. The best he or she can do is set it in motion. So far, all I've told you is that Google's crawlers scan the internet, sometimes find what appear to be suspect websites and put those websites on a quarantine list. That information is then conveyed to users through the search engine. So far, so good, except of course for the mistakes and the delisting problem. One might even say that Google is performing a public service, which is how some people who are familiar with the quarantine list defend it. But I also mentioned that Google somehow blocks people from accessing websites directly through multiple browsers. How on earth could it do that? How could Google block you when you are trying to access a website using Safari, an Apple product, or Firefox, a browser maintained by Mozilla, the self-proclaimed non-profit defender of the free and open internet? The key here is browsers. No browser maker wants to send you to a malicious website, and because Google has the best blacklist, major browsers such as Safari and Firefox and Chrome, of course, Google's own browser, as well as browsers that load through Android, Google's mobile operating system check Google's quarantine list before they send you to a website. If the site has been quarantined by Google, you see one of those big, scary images that say things like "Get me out of here" or "Reported attack site." At this point, given the default security settings on most browsers, most people will find it impossible to visit the site, but who would want to? If the site is not on Google's quarantine list, you are sent on your way.
Okay, that explains how Google blocks you even when you're using a non-Google browser, but why do they block you?
In other words, how does blocking you feed the ravenous advertising machine the sine qua non of Google's existence? Have you figured it out yet? The scam is as simple as it is brilliant. When a browser queries Google's quarantine list, it has just shared information with Google. With Chrome and Android, you are always giving up information to Google, but you are also doing so even if you are using non-Google browsers. That is where the money is: more information about search activity kindly provided by competing browser companies. How much information is shared will depend on the particular deal the browser company has with Google. In a maximum information deal, Google will learn the identity of the user. In a minimum information deal, Google will still learn which websites people want to visit. Valuable data when one is in the business of ranking websites. Google can also charge fees for access to its quarantine list, of course, but that's not where the real gold is. Chrome, Android, Firefox, and Safari currently carry about 92% of all browser traffic in the US, 74% worldwide, and these numbers are increasing. As of this writing, that means Google is regularly collecting information through its quarantine list from more than 2.5 billion people. Given the recent pact between Microsoft and Google, in coming months we might learn that Microsoft, both to save money and to improve its services, has also started using Google's quarantine list in place of its own much smaller list. This would further increase the volume of information Google is receiving. To put this another way, Google has grown, and is still growing, on the backs of some of its competitors, with end users oblivious to Google's antics as usual. It is yet another example of what I have called Google's dance, the remarkable way in which Google puts a false and friendly public face on activities that serve only one purpose for the company: increasing profit. On the surface, Google's quarantine list is yet another way Google helps us, free of charge, breeze through our day safe and well-informed. Beneath the surface, that list is yet another way Google accumulates more information about us to sell to advertisers. You may disagree, but in my view, Google's blacklisting practices put the company into the role of thuggish internet cop, a role that was never authorized by any government, non-profit organization, or industry association. It is as if the biggest bully in town suddenly put on a badge and started patrolling, shuttering businesses as it pleased, while also secretly peeping into windows, taking photos and selling them to the highest bidder. Consider, heading into the holiday season in late 2013, an online handbag business suffered a 50% drop in business because of blacklisting. In 2009, it took an eco-friendly pest control company 60 days to leap the hurdles required to remove Google's warnings, long enough to nearly go broke. And sometimes the blacklisting process appears to be personal. In May 2013, the highly opinionated PC magazine columnist John Dvorak wondered, when did Google become the internet police? After both his website and podcast site were blacklisted. He also ran into the delisting problem. "It's funny," he wrote, "how the site can be blacklisted in a millisecond by an analysis, but I have to wait forever to get cleared by the same analyst doing the same scan. Why is that? How frequently Google acts irresponsibly is beside the point. It has the ability to do so, which means that in a matter of seconds, any of Google's 37,000 employees with the right passwords or skills could laser a business or political candidate into oblivion or even freeze much of the world's economy.
Wow. That's a lot of restrictive manipulative power in the hands of just one alien, I mean rich elite organization across the whole planet. And speaking of severe global restrictive censorship by Google and other various social media giants like Facebook and Twitter, we also saw this nefarious behavior when it came to sharing, or should we say attempted sharing, of information concerning COVID-19. Again, even if a person doesn't agree with the establishment's views, behavior, or action in regard to the COVID-19 virus and the handling of it, shouldn't a person still have the right to free speech, you know, to say what they want to say about it? I mean, after all, this is the United States of America, right? The land of the free. Well, apparently, not anymore. See if this censorship sounds familiar.
In February, when the new coronavirus began to spread outside China, the Director General of the World Health Organization, WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, announced, "We are not just fighting an epidemic, we're fighting an infodemic." The term, coined in 2003 in the context of the first SARS epidemic, refers to a rapid proliferation of information that is often false or uncertain. Academic researchers, international organizations such as the United Nations and the European Union, individual governments and the media have acknowledged and discussed the prevalence of the alleged COVID-19 infodemic and the importance of fighting it. Information campaigns have been launched to provide wider audiences with reliable information about COVID-19. Main social media platforms have also actively fought against false information by filtering out or flagging content considered as misinformation. Censorship on major social media platforms, such as Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, is not a new phenomenon. These companies regularly remove content that they consider as objectionable based on continually updated categories outlined in their policies. Examples of objectionable content include hate speech, glorification of violence, or harmful and dangerous content. These categories are not only often broader than the exceptions to the freedom of speech entrenched in legislations of democratic countries, but also implicitly vague and leave plenty of room to interpretation. Indeed, an analysis of content banned on social networks suggests that the moderation is often politically biased. Some very recent examples of moderation with apparent political ramifications include Twitter's labeling of U.S. President Donald J. Trump's tweets as violating Twitter's policy about glorifying violence or abusive behavior, or adding a warning suggesting that a post was factually inaccurate. Social media platforms are private companies, and as such, one could argue, they should be able to decide what content they tolerate or not. However, such a view overlooks salient aspects of the issue. First, censorship on Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube appears to contradict the very idea of these communication networks, that is, of spaces where everyone can express their opinion. YouTube, for example, declares on its website that its mission is to give everyone a voice. Twitter's manager once described his company as the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, has similarly been vocal about Facebook's commitment to the freedom of speech. Many users of social media might have believed in these ideals when joining the online communities. Or, at least, they did not expect biased censorship on the platforms. From this point of view, appeals to the freedom of speech made by the social networks seem unfair or deceptive. Another important point to consider is the fact that a few big tech companies currently dominate social media services, which also serve as a source of news to many users. According to a 2020 survey by the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, 36% of 24,000 respondents from 12 countries use Facebook for news weekly, while 21% of the surveyed use YouTube for the same purpose. If we add to this the fact that Google is the most popular search engine, it becomes clear that a few tech companies have huge power over what information internet users can see and how their views are shaped. What is clear is that the tech giants' role in shaping public discourse has become apparent. the governments of various countries have either attempted to find a solution to this issue or to use the possibility of censorship by big tech companies for their own purposes. While it is difficult to overlook the politically motivated censorship on online platforms and its implications, the removal of misinformation related to medical topics such as COVID-19 may seem to belong to a different category, not political, but rather one of science, where information can be objectively judged based on scientific evidence. At a closer look, however, this does not seem to be the case. Censorship of information about COVID-19. In response to calls to combat misinformation about COVID-19, a group of companies, including among others Facebook, Twitter and YouTube, issued a joint statement in mid-March this year. They stated that they are jointly combating fraud and misinformation about the virus, elevating authoritative content on their platforms. Their actions include the introduction of educational pop-ups connecting people to information from the WHO, Facebook, adding warning labels to content considered as false or misleading, Facebook, Twitter, removing content contradicting health authorities or the WHO, YouTube, and content that could directly contribute or lead to physical harm, Facebook and Twitter. One example is a video removed by YouTube, in which a researcher, John Ioannidis, discussed data related to COVID-19, questioned the need to continue the ongoing lockdown and raised concerns about the negative impact of the restrictions. Other cases of censorship on major social media platforms have been reported, for example, removal of information about anti-quarantine protests on Facebook. A major question regarding the policies of the communication platforms is who exactly defines and how which information is deemed to be false or harmful? And can we rely on these judgments? One of the authoritative sources that all three major social media platforms mention in their policies on COVID-19 is the WHO. It is an established and influential organization, yet it may make mistakes, including in the context of handling epidemics. For example, concerns have been raised about influences of pharmaceutical companies on the guidelines related to the flu pandemic in 2009. A major question regarding the policies of the communication platforms is who exactly defines and how which information is deemed to be false or harmful. YouTube and Twitter also refer to guidelines from local health authorities. Although these are usually developed by experts and may be legally binding, this does not imply that they are unerring. There has been disagreement among researchers in medical sciences about the necessity for lockdown measures. Furthermore, researchers and many healthcare professionals have indicated numerous and serious negative impacts of the policies introduced to combat the spread of COVID-19 and expressed doubts about the evidence supporting these measures. This variety of opinions on how to handle the COVID-19 pandemic is related, among others, to the fact that it is a new disease and the knowledge about it is relatively limited and unsettled. Moreover, the implications of the pandemic and measures taken to counteract it exceed the remit of epidemiology or public health experts and fall into areas of economy, education, psychology, and sociology. Meanwhile, experts who develop policies or express opinions about COVID-19 may not have a complete overview of the implications of pandemic-related policies. Processes of reviewing research results, drawing conclusions, and preparing guidelines may be complex, prone to mistakes, and not immune to political or commercial interests. Additionally, there are the usual problems related to evaluation and translation of evidence into medical or public health practice. They include questions about the validity of a given study, limitations of methods, reproducibility of results, and so on. Processes of reviewing research results, drawing conclusions, and preparing guidelines may be complex, prone to mistakes, and not immune to political or commercial interests. Retracted articles on COVID-19, including publications in The Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine, suggest that research on COVID-19 is not an exception to problems related to the ethics of research. Constructive critique, questioning of evidence and opinions of scientists and policymakers are thus necessary to identify and correct potential errors and to prevent them from being propagated. By following their policies on COVID-19, social media platforms filter out content which contradicts specific views that are not necessarily correct or unanimously accepted, with respect to the underlying scientific evidence or represented values and political views. If critique of these views is eliminated or restricted, the possibility to correct errors, contribute to the understanding of the topic and inform public debate is limited. Additionally, since the censorship is not based solely on science, as scientific evidence is currently limited and medical experts still disagree on various topics, other factors influence decisions to remove content. Questions about the commitment to the freedom of speech of the social media providers and risk of manipulation of public opinion are therefore relevant also in case of information about COVID-19.
I couldn't have put it better myself. Notice how they too use the word manipulation concerning public opinion. This is going on, folks, on a massive global scale by these tech and social media companies, whether we realize it or not. Even secular researchers are admitting it. And speaking of manipulation, as if what we've seen so far wasn't bad enough, it is now known that Google and the various social media giants are not only subliminally controlling and filtering what information we receive from them, but they are now guilty of even subliminally influencing election results even here in the United States. I know it sounds crazy, but here's more of that proof.
Late in 2012, I began to wonder whether highly ranked search results could be impacting more than consumer choices. Perhaps, I speculated, a top search result could have a small impact on people's opinions about things. Early in 2013, with my associate Ronald E. Robertson of the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology in Vista, California, I put this idea to a test by conducting an experiment in which 102 people from the San Diego area were randomly assigned to one of three groups. In one group, people saw search results that favored one political candidate, that is, results that linked to web pages that made this candidate look better than his or her opponent. In a second group, people saw search rankings that favored the opposing candidate, and in the third group, the control group, people saw a mix of rankings that favored neither candidate. The same search results and web pages were used in each group. The only thing that differed for the three groups was the ordering of the search results. To make our experiment realistic, we used real search results that linked to real web pages. We also used a real election, the 2010 election for the Prime Minister of Australia. We used a foreign election to make sure that our participants were undecided. Their lack of familiarity with the candidates assured this. Through advertisements, we also recruited an ethnically diverse group of registered voters over a wide age range in order to match key demographic characteristics of the US voting population. All participants were first given brief descriptions of the candidates and then asked to rate them in various ways, as well as to indicate which candidate they would vote for. As you might expect, participants initially favored neither candidate on any of the five measures we used, and the vote was evenly split in all three groups. Then the participants were given up to 15 minutes in which to conduct an online search using KDoodle, our mock search engine, which gave them access to five pages of search results that linked to web pages. People could move freely between search results and web pages, just as we do when using Google. When participants completed their search, we asked them to rate the candidates again, and we also asked them again who they would vote for. We predicted that the opinions and voting preferences of 2 or 3% of the people in the two bias groups, the groups in which people were seeing rankings favoring one candidate, would shift toward that candidate. What we actually found was astonishing. The proportion of people favoring the search engine's top-ranked candidate increased by 48.4%, and all five of our measures shifted toward that candidate. What's more, 75% of the people in the bias group seemed to have been completely unaware that they were viewing biased search rankings. In the control group, opinions did not shift significantly. This seemed to be a major discovery. The shift we had produced, which we called the search engine manipulation effect, or SEEM, pronounced SEEM, appeared to be one of the largest behavioral effects ever discovered. We did not immediately uncork the champagne bottle, however. For one thing, we had tested only a small number of people, and they were all from the San Diego area. Over the next year or so, we replicated our findings three more times, and the third time was with a sample of more than 2,000 people from all 50 US states. In that experiment, the shift in voting preferences was 37.1% and even higher in some demographic groups, as high as 80%, in fact. We also learned in this series of experiments that by reducing the bias just slightly on the first page of search results specifically, by including one search item that favored the other candidate in the third or fourth position of the results, we could mask our manipulation so that few or even no people were aware that they were seeing biased rankings.
We could still produce dramatic shifts in voting preferences, but we could do so invisibly.
Still no champagne, though. Our results were strong and consistent, but our experiments all involved a foreign election, that 2010 election in Australia. Could voting preferences be shifted with real voters in the middle of a real campaign?
We were skeptical.
In real elections, people are bombarded with multiple sources of information, and they also know a lot about the candidates. It seemed unlikely that a single experience on a search engine would have much impact on their voting preferences. To find out, in early 2014, we went to India just before voting began in the largest democratic election in the world, the Lok Sabha election for Prime Minister. The three main candidates were Rahul Gandhi, Arvind Kejriwal, and Narendra Modi. Making use of online subject pools and both online and print advertisements, we recruited 2,150 people from 27 of India's 35 states and territories to participate in our experiment.
To take part, they had to be registered voters who had not yet voted, and who were still undecided about how they would vote.
Participants were randomly assigned to three search engine groups, favoring, respectively, Gandhi, Kejriwal or Modi. As one might expect, familiarity levels with the candidates was high, between 7.7 and 8.5 on a scale of 10.
We predicted that our manipulation would produce a very small effect, if any, but that's not what we found.
On average, we were able to shift the proportion of people favoring any given candidate by more than 20% overall and more than 60% in some demographic groups. Even more disturbing, 99.5% of our participants showed no awareness that they were viewing biased search rankings, in other words, that they were being manipulated. Seems near invisibility is curious indeed.
It means that when people, including you and me, are looking at biased search rankings, they look just fine.
So, if right now you Google US presidential candidates, the search results you see will probably look fairly random, even if they happen to favor one candidate. Even I have trouble detecting bias in search rankings that I know to be biased, because they were prepared by my staff. Yet our randomized, controlled experiments tell us over and over again that when higher-ranked items connect with web pages that favor one candidate, this has a dramatic impact on the opinions of undecided voters, in large part for the simple reason that people tend to click only on higher-ranked items. This is truly scary. Like subliminal stimuli, seem is a force you can't see, but unlike subliminal stimuli, it has an enormous impact, like Casper the ghost pushing you down a flight of stairs. We published a detailed report about our first five experiments on SEEM in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, PNAS, in August 2015. We had indeed found something important, especially given Google's dominance over search. Google has a near monopoly on internet searches in the US, with 83% of Americans specifying Google as the search engine they use most often, according to the Pew Research Center. So, if Google favors one candidate in an election, its impact on undecided voters could easily decide the election's outcome.
Keep in mind that we had had only one shot at our participants.
What would be the impact of favoring one candidate in searches people are conducting over a period of weeks or months before an election?
It would almost certainly be much larger than what we were seeing in our experiments.
Other types of influence during an election campaign are balanced by competing sources of influence, a wide variety of newspapers, radio shows and television networks, for example, but Google, for all intents and purposes, has no competition, and people trust its search results implicitly, assuming that the company's mysterious search algorithm is entirely objective and unbiased. This high level of trust, combined with the lack of competition, puts Google in a unique position to impact elections. Even more disturbing, the search ranking business is entirely unregulated, so Google could favor any candidate it likes without violating any laws. Some courts have even ruled that Google's right to rank order search results as it pleases is protected as a form of free speech.
Does the company ever favor particular candidates?
In the 2012 US presidential election, Google and its top executives donated more than $800,000 to President Barack Obama and just $37,000 to his opponent, Mitt Romney. And in 2015, a team of researchers from the University of Maryland and elsewhere showed that Google's search results routinely favor Democratic candidates. Are Google's search rankings really biased? An internal report issued by the U.S. Federal Trade Commission in 2012 concluded that Google's search rankings routinely put Google's financial interests ahead of those of their competitors, and antitrust actions currently underway against Google in both the European Union and India are based on similar findings. In most countries, 90% of online search is conducted on Google, which gives the company even more power to flip elections than it has in the U.S. and, with internet penetration increasing rapidly worldwide, this power is growing. In Arna's article, Robertson and I calculated that Google now has the power to flip upwards of 25% of the national elections in the world with no one knowing this is occurring. In fact, we estimate that, with or without deliberate planning on the part of company executives, Google's search rankings have been impacting elections for years, with growing impact each year.
And because search rankings are ephemeral, they leave no paper trail, which gives the company complete deniability. Power on this scale and with this level of invisibility is unprecedented in human history. But it turns out that our discovery about Seam was just the tip of a very large iceberg. Recent reports suggest that former Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton made heavy use of social media to try to generate support: Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, Snapchat, and Facebook, for starters. She had 5.4 million followers on Twitter, and her staff was tweeting several times an hour during waking hours. Is social media as big a threat to democracy as search rankings appear to be? What happens if such technologies are misused by the companies that own them? A study by Robert M. Bond, now a political science professor at Ohio State University, and others published in Nature in 2012 described an ethically questionable experiment in which, on election day in 2010, Facebook sent go out and vote reminders to more than 60 million of its users.
The reminders caused about 340,000 people to vote who otherwise would not have.
Writing in The New Republic in 2014, Jonathan Zittrain, professor of international law at Harvard University, pointed out that, given the massive amount of information it has collected about its users, Facebook could easily send such messages only to people who support one particular party or candidate, and that doing so could easily flip a close election with no one knowing that this has occurred.
And because advertisements, like search rankings, are ephemeral, manipulating an election in this way would leave no paper trail.
Are there laws prohibiting Facebook from sending out ads selectively to certain users? Absolutely not. In fact, targeted advertising is how Facebook makes its money. Is Facebook currently manipulating elections in this way?
No one knows, but some candidates are better for a company than others, and Facebook's executives have a fiduciary responsibility to the company's stockholders to promote the company's interests.
Another Facebook experiment, published in 2014 in NAS, prompted protests around the world. In this study, for a period of a week, 689,000 Facebook users were sent news feeds that contained either an excess of positive terms, an excess of negative terms, or neither. Those in the first group subsequently used slightly more positive terms in their communications, while those in the second group used slightly more negative terms in their communications. This was said to show that people's emotional states could be deliberately manipulated on a massive scale by a social media company, an idea that many people found disturbing. People were also upset that a large-scale experiment on emotion had been conducted without the explicit consent of any of the participants. Facebook's consumer profiles are undoubtedly massive, but they pale in comparison with those maintained by Google, which is collecting information about people 24/7, using more than 60 different observation platforms, the search engine, of course, but also Google Wallet, Google Maps, Google AdWords, Google Analytics, Chrome, Google Docs, Android, YouTube, and on and on. Gmail users are generally oblivious to the fact that Google stores and analyzes every email they write, even the drafts they never send, as well as all the incoming email they receive from both Gmail and non-Gmail users.
If Google set about to fix an election, it could identify just those voters who are undecided. Then it could send customized rankings favoring one candidate to just those people.
According to Google's privacy policy, to which one assents whenever one uses a Google product, even when one has not been informed that he or she is using a Google product, Google can share the information it collects about you with almost anyone, including government agencies.
But never with you. Google's privacy is sacrosanct, yours is non-existent.
Could Google and those we work with, language from the privacy policy, use the information they are amassing about you for nefarious purposes to manipulate or coerce, for example? Could inaccurate information in people's profiles, which people have no way to correct, limit their opportunities or ruin their reputations? Certainly, if Google set about to fix an election, it could first dip into its massive database of personal information to identify just those voters who are undecided. Then it could, day after day, send customized rankings favoring one candidate to just those people. One advantage of this approach is that it would make Google's manipulation extremely difficult for investigators to detect. Extreme forms of monitoring, whether by the KGB in the Soviet Union, the Stasi in East Germany, or Big Brother in 1984, are essential elements of all tyrannies, and technology is making both monitoring and the consolidation of surveillance data easier than ever. By 2020, China will have put in place the most ambitious government monitoring system ever created, a single database called the Social Credit System, in which multiple ratings and records for all of its 1.3 billion citizens are recorded for easy access by officials and bureaucrats. At a glance, they will know whether someone has plagiarized schoolwork, was tardy in paying bills, urinated in public, or blobbed inappropriately online. As Edward Snowden's revelations made clear, we are rapidly moving toward a world in which both governments and corporations sometimes working together are collecting massive amounts of data about every one of us every day, with few or no laws in place that restrict how those data can be used. When you combine the data collection with the desire to control or manipulate, the possibilities are endless, but perhaps the most frightening possibility is the one expressed in Bolding's assertion that an unseen dictatorship was possible using the forms of democratic government. Since Robertson and I submitted our initial report on Seemton as early in 2015, we have completed a sophisticated series of experiments that have greatly enhanced our understanding of this phenomenon, and other experiments will be completed in the coming months.
We have a much better sense now of why Seem is so powerful and how, to some extent, it can be suppressed. We have also learned something very disturbing, that search engines are influencing far more than what people buy and whom they vote for.
We now have evidence suggesting that on virtually all issues where people are initially undecided, search rankings are impacting almost every decision that people make. They are having an impact on the opinions, beliefs, attitudes and behaviors of internet users worldwide entirely without people's knowledge that this is occurring. This is happening with or without deliberate intervention by company officials. Even so-called organic search processes regularly generate search results that favor one point of view, and that in turn has the potential to tip the opinions of millions of people who are undecided on an issue. In one of our recent experiments, biased search results shifted people's opinions about the value of fracking by 33.9%. Perhaps even more disturbing is that the handful of people who do show awareness that they are viewing biased search rankings shift even further in the predicted direction. Simply knowing that a list is biased doesn't necessarily protect you from Seem's power. Remember what the search algorithm is doing. In response to your query, it is selecting a handful of web pages from among the billions that are available, and it is ordering those web pages using secret criteria. Seconds later, the decision you make or the opinion you form about the best toothpaste to use, whether fracking is safe, where you should go on your next vacation, who would make the best president, or whether global warming is real is determined by that short list you are shown, even though you have no idea how the list was generated. The technology has made possible undetectable and untraceable manipulations of entire populations that are beyond the scope of existing regulations and laws.
Meanwhile, behind the scenes, a consolidation of search engines has been quietly taking place, so that more people are using the dominant search engine even when they think they are not.
Because Google is the best search engine, and because crawling the rapidly expanding internet has become prohibitively expensive, more and more search engines are drawing their information from the leader rather than generating it themselves. We are living in a world in which a handful of high-tech companies, sometimes working hand-in-hand with governments, are not only monitoring much of our activity, but are also invisibly controlling more and more of what we think, feel, do and say. The technology that now surrounds us is not just a harmless toy, it has also made possible undetectable and untraceable manipulations of entire populations, manipulations that have no precedent in human history and that are currently well beyond the scope of existing regulations and laws.
The new hidden persuaders are bigger, bolder and badder than anything Vance Packard ever envisioned.
If we choose to ignore this, we do so at our peril.
Which is precisely why we are doing this documentary and why we've entitled it, Subliminal Seduction: How the Mass Media Mesmerizes the Minds of the Masses. As you can see, this is really happening on a grand global scale from a multitude of media outlets, and it's frankly sick and disturbing. You not only have devised a wicked scheme to subliminally control all information people are receiving for brainwashing purposes, but you are also subliminally determining people's so-called election choices. Yeah, whose choice is it really? In fact, as sad as those manipulative facts are, even secular researchers are catching up to the fact that this kind of subliminal persuasion and silencing of dissenting views, and controlling and monitoring even blacklisting and banning of all information that appears online including on social media, is really going on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on a global basis, like this researcher shares.
Roya Inshafi, Assistant Professor Computer Science and Engineering, University of Michigan. One of the core principles behind the design of the internet was that users from everywhere should get the same experience. Censored Planet is the first global internet censorship observatory that collects data continuously from more than 170 countries without end users' participation. Censored Planet uses advanced algorithms that can remotely detect network anomalies in order to track whether users around the world have access to thousands of important websites. The reason why I am interested to monitor and bring transparency and accountability to this phenomenon is that I strongly believe that it takes away opportunity, and it degrades human dignity for many who experience it. The technology behind internet censorship is becoming cheaper and cheaper, so it is very affordable for governments, states, you name it, to just buy this and deploy it. There are three common ways that the governments block content. One is by blocking the IP address. There is also DNS poisoning, where the DNS query is going to be poisoned or redirected to where the content is not there. The third kind is application layer blocking or keyword blocking, where the sensor monitors the traffic and notices there is sensitive keyword that is being communicated. As a result of that, it's blocked, or actually it shows the user a blocked page where it says this content is not legal. So, Censored Planet captures all of these three kinds of monitoring techniques. Previous projects for monitoring global censorship have relied on volunteers around the world to collect data. But asking citizens in sensitive countries to participate could put them at risk. Censored Planet requires zero user participation, providing a safe method for tracking censorship everywhere so we can better understand what governments are blocking and why. I grew up with the internet being censored either by university, by government, or more importantly by servers who provide the information. More and more I realize that internet censorship should be put into global perspective. It's not just Iran, just China. What I think is important is having a transparency on the process. Who is deciding to block what, and do we have trust in those people for the decisions they're making?
And the resounding answer would be, absolutely not. Based on their behavior, these people cannot be trusted, they're lying to us, they're deceiving us, manipulating us, even subliminally affecting our beliefs, buying habits, and even who to vote for. I didn't sign up for that, did you? But, as you can see, how much more proof do we need to see that these aliens, I mean rich elites, are literally controlling all forms media on the whole planet, including the World Wide Web or internet and all of social media, and we're only getting what these elite owners want us to get, that is, their pre-programmed narrative that subliminally promotes their own nefarious agenda, not our desires, not the facts, not the truth. And as bad as that is, it's about to get even worse. As horrible and rotten as what you just saw concerning the manipulation of social media by these aliens, I mean rich elites, is, believe it or not, these same manipulative elites are not only controlling all the social media content around the whole world, but they are actually subliminally manipulate us with a technology that's purposely addictive like television, so we never cut the feed off from their daily subliminal programming of our minds. If you don't believe me, here's just some of that proof.
Adam Alter, author, Irresistible, Your Phone is a Dopamine Pump. Behavioral addiction is a lot like substance addiction in a lot of ways, but it's much newer. So, substance addiction obviously involves the ingestion of a substance, and in the short term that feels good, and in the long term it harms your well-being in some respects. It can be physiological, it can be psychological, it can harm your social life, it can cause you to spend too much money, it can have a lot of negative effects on your life. Behavioral addiction is similar. The big difference, though, is that behavioral addiction does not involve ingestion of a substance, and it's much newer. It's a much more recent phenomenon. So, substance addiction has been around for a very long time, by some accounts for many thousands of years, but there weren't behaviors around that were compelling enough to rise to the level of addiction until quite recently. The reason is that for them to be addictive, basically what has to happen is there's a behavior that you enjoy doing in the short term that you do compulsively. So, you keep returning to it over and over again, but then in the long term it harms your well-being. And it can, again, harm your well-being in lots of different respects: social, financial, physical, psychological. And I think the reason why we've got these new forms of addiction, there are two main reasons. The first one is that technology is much more sophisticated and advanced than it was even 20 years ago. You're able to deliver the kinds of rewards that you need for a system to be addictive. So basically, what people are looking for is unpredictability and rapid feedback of either rewards, or if it's negative, then negative experiences, and you actually need that mix of positive and negative feedback. Just as, for example, when you post something online, sometimes you're going to get a lot of hits, sometimes you aren't, and it's that unpredictability that we find so compelling. You need to be able to deliver those rewards really rapidly, and for that you need the internet with the right kind of bandwidth to be able to deliver those rewards. The other thing that I think has happened is that companies are much savvier about this. There are employing behavioral experts to tell them how to design their media, how to design the vehicles that deliver those media, smartphones, iPads, smartwatches, things like that. And for that reason, I think they are delivering products to us that are harder for us to resist. They've got enough features built in that we find to be pretty hard to resist, and then we end up developing addictions to them. And by some counts, that applies to about half of the population of the developed world. It turns out that it's not the addiction to the device itself. The device is just an incredibly effective way of delivering addictive content. So, when you're addicted to a screen, it's not that the screen itself is something that you can't get enough of. It's what it's providing. I think one of the reasons why we are so addicted to screens, or to the content they provide, is that they go with us wherever we go. And that's relatively new. And so, if you played video games in the 80s or 90s or even the early 2000s, they didn't really go wherever you went as much as they do now, especially those games that were tied to the internet. Those were tied to your PC, you'd play where you were, and you didn't really leave with them as much. You had some portable devices, but those were much more primitive. Today with iPhones you can connect to other people on the go, you always have access to games, you always have access to email, you always have access to the internet, and you always have access to social media, and so they are great vehicles for providing the hits that you need when you need them. Basically, we tend to develop addictions when we have a psychological need. And we get those whenever we're bored, whenever we're feeling a little bit lonely, whenever we're not really sure what to do with ourselves next, whenever we don't feel particularly efficacious, like we're having an effect on the world that we'd like to be having. Those are the moments when you're looking for what some people call the adult pacifier. And smartphones tend to be a great adult pacifier, because after those moments you turn on your screen, you swipe, and you feel relaxed again. That's how people describe the experience. So, they tend to be excellent devices for delivering these small hits that we look for, and social media is a great example. So, social media obviously now travels with us. It used to be confined to home computers to a large extent, but that's no longer the case. And people spend about 3 hours a day on average using their smartphones, which is pretty staggering. That is a huge chunk of the day of the waking hours that we spend when we're not at work. And what that means is they're spending a lot of the time returning over and over again to check Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, and so on, and they're checking for a number of things. One thing is that these media are bottomless, which means that you're constantly checking for new information, there's always something new to be kept up on. The other thing is if you happen to be a poster of content, you're very curious about getting rapid feedback as to whether people approve of that or they're not particularly interested in it. So, a lot of the time what we do is we return over and over again compulsively to see whether we're getting the positive feedback that we seek when we post content.
IQ Millennial Question. We know that engaging with social media and our cell phones releases a chemical called dopamine. That's why when you get a text, it feels good. Right? We've all had it, when we feel a little bit down, or a little bit lonely, so you send out 10 texts to 10 friends, and get a hi. Because it feels good when you get a response. That's why we count the likes. That's why we go back 10 times to see if it's going, and if my Instagram is going slower, did I do something wrong, don't they like me anymore? The trauma for kids is to be unfriended. Because when we get it, we get a dose of dopamine. It feels good, it's why we like it and why we keep going back. Dopamine is the exact same chemical that makes us feel good when we smoke, when we drink, and when we gamble. In other words, it's highly, highly addictive. Right? We have age restrictions on smoking, gambling, and alcohol, and no age restrictions on social media and cell phones. It's the equivalent of opening up the liquor cabinet and saying to our teenagers, "Hey, by the way, if this adolescent thing gets you down." But that basically is what is happening.
Yeah, real funny. But he admitted, this is basically what's happening. Cell phone, social media, internet activities are just as additive as alcohol and cigarettes, and both of those are regulated and even have to have warning labels. But nothing for social media, the internet, or cell phones. And we wonder why people can't seem to shut it off. It's simple. They got tricked into getting hooked on an addictive content. By aliens I mean rich elites who didn't tell anyone that they created this addiction on purpose called social media, the internet, and cell phones, just like they already did with television. It's the exact same pattern. These elites really are using these various new global media technologies to keep people from ever turning away from their daily brainwashing procedures in order to not only get us to buy things to fill their pockets with our cash, to the tune of billions, but to program us and reprogram us into believing, behaving, acting, and thinking whatever they want us to, including who we vote for. This is what social media is really all about, just like television. And now, globally, add to daily average home usage of television, nearly 7 hours, to the average time a person spends on social media, an additional 2 hours 24 minutes, with some people like teenagers up to 9 hours a day, think about just how much the planet is being voluntarily brainwashed through these addictive platforms that they just can't seem to shut off on a global basis. And what are the results? The elites have now created a society of global brainwashed addictive zombies, like this short film demonstrates.
The clip opens with the cartoon characters walking down the street, in a single file, staring at their cell phones, not looking where they are going, and each one steps right into a manhole. A little child is sitting on the sidewalk looking at all the passers-by that all seem to be walking with their heads down looking at their phones. The child is amazed at what he is seeing. These people do not seem to have any idea of where they are going. On one corner, a crowd has gathered to watch a fight going on. No one is trying to stop it. One guy is getting beat up by three other guys, but all the people are gathered around just to take pictures with their phones. Then he passes by a restaurant, and when he looks in the window, these people aren't even looking at what they are putting in their mouths. All they seem to be doing is look at their cell phones. Even the baby in the high chair has his own phone to look at. As he goes farther down the street, he sees that the traffic has come to a stop. There is a fire in one of the buildings, but what catches his eye is a lady is taking a selfie with the fire blazing in the background. He decides he needs to go home and gets on the bus. But once again, no one seems to know where they are going. All of them have their attention only on their cell phones. They are so involved in the phones that they don't even notice when a girl on the bus is getting bothered by a bully. No one was there to save her. With the different apps that are found on the phones, you can make yourself look like another person. He finally comes to a point he has to sit down and try to figure this all out. A little dog comes up to him, and just as he is about to pet it, someone not looking where they are going kicks the little dog farther down the street. That person had his head buried in his cell phone and wasn't watching where he was going or that he even kicked the dog. It's like all these people have been mesmerized and are living in another world. People are taking pictures of their food with their cameras on their phones. He tries to get their attention, anyone's attention, but no one even sees him. They are too busy reading, playing games, talking, taking pictures of the girl dancing in the street. They are like sheep going to slaughter or like people worshipping an idol. They all just follow the crowd and really paying any attention to where they are being led. A baby is born but crawls out of the room while the parents are taking pictures of themselves in the delivery room. They don't even notice that the baby is gone. A girl is on a ledge on a skyscraper. When she looks down, all the people are taking her picture on their phones. But no one seems to be concerned with her jumping. As she jumps, their cameras follow her all the way to the ground, not missing a minute of the tragedy. The child sheds a tear. What has this world come to? It seems the whole population is following the crowd, with their eyes staring at their phones, and they all walk right over the cliff.
Wow. Looks like these aliens, I mean rich elites, have been successful in their takeover. They have now created, through their various forms of addictive global media, a society of brainwashed zombies who have no mind of their own, who will do, believe, behave, buy and even vote for whoever these aliens, I mean rich elites, want them to. And lest you think these elites don't know what they're doing to us, including the harm they're causing using with their addictive technologies, this is precisely why these same social media giants refuse to let their own children have access to this same kind of media. They don't want them brainwashed and messed up like the rest of us. Talk about hypocrisy. Check this out.
The tech moguls who invented social media have banned their children from it. Silicon Valley parents are pulling the plug. I have a huge TV in my living room, and I think we had a baseball game on in the background. We weren't even watching it or interacting with it. But then something curious happened. One dad, another figure in the tech industry, was sitting on the couch, holding his baby, which began looking around the room, and its mother obscured its view of the screen, saying, "No, you're not going to watch television at all until you're 3 years old." She thought the baby being on this couch would be permanently damaging to her child. This kind of behavior is becoming increasingly common as many of the tech world's leading lights, whose products have been used by millions of children the world over, are now intent on curbing their own offspring's screen time. Not content with banning their children's devices, they are now legally stipulating that staff do the same. A report last weekend documented the rise in nanny contracts requiring that Silicon Valley sprogs not only be kept away from their own screens, but that those tasked with looking after them don't use their phones in front of the children, either. Apple co-founder Steve Jobs was the first tech giant to admit, in 2011, that his own children had not used the recently released iPad created by his company, conceding that we limit how much technology our kids use at home. And he wasn't alone. Microsoft founder Bill Gates set time limits on screens, banned mobile phones at the table and didn't let his children have them until they were 14, while Mark Zuckerberg implored his baby daughter to stop and smell the flowers in an open letter to her which he released last year, one that made no mention of Facebook or even the internet. Silicon Valley parents are strict when it comes to their children's screen time. Those at the very top, who were often barely out of university when they had their billion-dollar ideas, are now grown-ups with partners and children. Zuckerberg was still in his teens when he launched Facebook, now he's a 34-year-old father of two. Marissa Mayer, the former chief executive of Yahoo, was not yet 25 when she became employee number 20 at Google. She has since had three children. Jeff Bezos was 30 and newly married when he founded Amazon in his garage. He and his wife are now parents of four. Yet it is unlikely that this will lead to a crisis of conscience, says Adam Alter, a professor of marketing at New York University and author of a recent book about technology addiction, because it would be completely inconsistent with the duty they have to their shareholders, to maximize profits. For all the advantages they and their kids enjoy, from wealth to education, they don't trust themselves or their kids to be able to resist the charms of the very products they're promoting. It would be silly to expect them to change, he says. The best we can do is to try to uncover these hypocrisies and air them publicly.
Which is again, precisely why we're doing this documentary. Yet, as bad and hypocritical as that behavior by the elites is, unfortunately, the negative and oftentimes dangerous side effects of social media is about to get even worse, at least for the rest of us. You see, this subliminal zombie-like hypnotic addictive form of global media called social media is not only being used to control the narrative of all information that we're receiving around the whole planet to mesmerize the minds of the masses for these aliens, I mean rich elites and their nefarious purposes. It's also simultaneously creating the immoral society full of destructive behaviors that God warned about would come upon the scene when you're living in the last days. Let's take a look at what social media is now doing morally to people all over the planet. It's not good.
IQ millennial question. It's an entire generation that has access to an addictive, numbing chemical called dopamine through social media and cell phones as they're going through the high stress of adolescence. Why is this important? Almost every alcoholic discovered alcohol when they were teenagers. When we are very, very young, the only approval we need is the approval of our parents, and as we go through adolescence, we make this transition where we now need the approval of our peers. Very frustrating for our parents. Very important for us. That allows us to acculturate outside of our immediate families into the broader tribe. It's a highly, highly stressful and anxious period of our lives, and we're supposed to learn to rely on our friends. Some people quite by accident discover alcohol and numbing effects of dopamine to help them cope with the stresses and anxieties of adolescence. Unfortunately, that becomes hardwired in their brains, and for the rest of their lives, when they suffer significant stress, they will not turn to a person, they will turn to the bottle. Social stress, financial stress, career stress, that's pretty much the primary reason why an alcoholic drinks. Right, what's happening is, because we're allowing unfettered access to these dopamine-producing devices and media. Basically, it's becoming hardwired, and what we're seeing is, as they grow older, too many kids don't know how to form deep, meaningful relationships. Their words, not mine. They will admit that many of their friendships are superficial. They will admit that they don't count on their friends. They don't rely on their friends, they have fun with their friends, but they also know that their friends will cancel out on them if something better comes along. Deep, meaningful relationships are not there because they never practice the skill set, and worse, they don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with stress. So, when significant stress starts to show up in their lives, they're not turning to a person. They're turning to a device, they're turning to social media, they're turning to these things which offer temporary relief. We know, the science is clear, we know that people who spend more time on Facebook have far higher rates of depression than people who spend less time on Facebook. If you are sitting at dinner with your friends and you're texting somebody who's not there, that's a problem. That's an addiction. If you're sitting in a meeting with people, you're supposed to be listening to and speaking, and you put your phone on the table, face up or face down, I don't care, that sends a subconscious message to the room that you're just not that important to me right now. That's what happens, and the fact that you cannot put it away is because you are addicted. If you wake up and check your phone before you say good morning to your girlfriend, boyfriend or spouse, you have an addiction, and like all addictions in time, it'll destroy relationships, it'll cost time, and it will cost money, and will make your life worse.
The job interview.
Amy, it says you are trained in technology, that is very good. She is texting on her cell phone, are you adept at Excel?
No.
PowerPoint?
No.
Publisher?
Not really.
Exactly in what area of technology are you proficient in?
Snapchat, Pinterest, Instagram, Vine, Twitter, you know the big ones.
I'm surprised you didn't say Facebook.
She laughs at that comment.
That's for old people, like my parents.
She laughs again.
That's funny.
Well, Amy, when you are working for me, you have to have those kind of research skills because I'll send you things for you to comb through and get the answers and send them to me. So, for that you've got to be really good at technology.
For stuff like that, no problem, I'll just ask Siri.
You'll just ask Siri.
You know, Siri told me this, Siri find me that, we're all good at getting you the answers.
Tell Siri I want you ready to go at 8 o'clock sharp each and every morning.
I don't you understand.
What don't you understand?
What you just said.
You don't understand, be ready to go.
No, you said 8 o'clock, right?
Yes.
8 o'clock, like in the morning? 8 o'clock?
Yes. In the morning.
Yeah, that kind of doesn't work for me. Who gets up at 8 o'clock?
I do.
I Skype with my French boyfriend in Paris until like 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't even get to Starbucks until like 10 o'clock, where I order my grande chai tea latte, 3 pumps skim milk, light water, 2% foam extra hot, but not too hot. So, if it's okay, I work best in the morning at 10:45.
Wow. Amy, I don't think we're gonna be a good fit.
Why are you being so negative? I can sense your hostilities, and right now I am not feeling very safe.
She stands up to leave.
I've been here for over 5 minutes, and the only nice thing you have said to me was nice resume, which I typed all night for this meeting with you. You've given me no guidance, no validation, no encouragement, no supervision. Is there an HR director somewhere?
She is reading this from her cell phone.
HR director.
Yes, I need to speak to someone. I may have to take off today as a mental health day.
Take the day off. You, Amy, Amy, look at me. You don't work here.
Are you firing me?
Okay, yes.
She takes a couple deep breaths and turns around and leaves.
Absolute motivation. Imagine when you take that to extreme, where bad actors can now manipulate large swaths of people to do anything you want. It's a really, really bad state of affairs, and we compound the problem, right? We curate our lives around this perceived sense of perfection because we get rewarded in these short-term signals. Hearts, likes, thumbs up, and we conflate that with value, and we conflate it with truth and instead of what it really is. It's fake brittle popularity that's short-term and that leaves you even more, and admit it, vacant and empty, before you did it, because then it forces you into this vicious cycle where you're like, what's the next thing I need to do now because I need it back? Think about that, compounded by 2 billion people, and then think about how people react then to the perceptions of other. It's really bad. So, we know from the research literature that the more you use social media, the more likely you are to feel lonely or isolated. We know that the constant exposure to your friends' carefully curated positive portrayals of their life can leave you to feel inadequate and can increase rates of depression. And something I think we're going to be hearing more about in the near future is that there's a fundamental mismatch between the way our brains are wired and this behavior of exposing yourself to stimuli with intermittent rewards throughout all of your waking hours. So, it's one thing to spend a couple of hours at the slot machines in Las Vegas, but if you bring the slot machine with you and you pull that handle all day long, from when you wake up to when you go to bed, we're not wired from it. It short-circuits the brain. We're starting to find that it has actual cognitive consequences, one of them being the sort of pervasive background hum of anxiety.
A mother, I found an app. It was kind of like hidden. I went into it and I found photos on there of my daughter. She's 13 or 14, one more year is off the deep end.
A dad, I said, where did you meet this person? He said, on Facebook. He had a whole digital life that I hadn't even known existed.
Female student, I got to create my life the way I wanted to be seen, and I would try to become that in real life even though it wasn't my true reality.
Male student, when I ever saw a friend request, I got so happy. I thought that everyone that I accepted was actually going to be a friend of mine.
Doctor. 50% of the kids when asked say they feel addicted to their social media. We let the kids go into their own room doing their own things. We are busy, and we are tired, and we want to do our own thing. When you go into an average high school, 1 in 4 of those kids will admit to having sent a naked picture of themselves to a friend or stranger.
If your kid was smart, he could look up anything you want.
It's a free-for-all, there's pornography, there's constant reinforcement, pings, dings, new friends. Minister, we are concerned. We are really concerned about the influence of media, mass media, social media.
Teacher, it's as new to us as it is to our kids. Switching from a teaching mode to a training mode.
They called me fatty. You're so dumb. Where they start getting you is where you believe.
That becomes their life. Social media world, but that world can be quickly abandoned.
I had a gun at my head.
And what did God say? In the last days, your society would become filled with all kinds of absolute, utterly dangerous, destructive behaviors, to the point where they would not only be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, not lovers of the good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, but even become brutal. And that's the perfect word to describe what we're seeing today with people's behavior, thanks to brainwashing from all these emerging global media technologies, including social media. It's the same rule and same pattern. Junk in equals junk out. If you ingest hours and hours on end of immoral and addictive and dangerous and even destructive content on social media, your life will begin to reflect it. And the next thing you know, you wake up with an extremely immoral society around the whole planet, just like God warned about 2,000 years ago. But unfortunately, that's only half of it. Remember the other consistent pattern here? These same aliens, I mean rich elites, are also using the global media of social media to create the biggest scoffing society in the history of mankind against God, Jesus, the Bible, and Christianity. See if you agree with just a few of the current headlines out there.
Social media platforms censoring Christians. Is Facebook censoring Christian content? Social media to erode the Christian belief system. Facebook will go after conservative, Christian content. Christian posts blocked. Will Christian speech be allowed in the new Facebook world? Christian organization removed from Twitter. Guy banned from Twitch for his religion. Christian Kevin Sorbo speaks out after Facebook removed his page. Twitter ban, censorship on a way of talking, does that include Christian speech? Twitter bans Bible verses. Did Facebook really ban the I am a Christian ad? Is Facebook banning Bible passages? Facebook bans censorship and Christian faith. Is censorship escalating against evangelicals? Facebook accused of censoring Christian views. Christian TikTok videos are censored and deleted in the US. Why is Twitter censoring Jews and Christians? Anti-Christian censorship and new media. YouTube cancels Christian Media Network, deletes over 15,000 videos. YouTube ad policy bans keyword Christian.
Gee, I wonder why so many people around the planet are becoming so anti-Christian, anti-God, anti-Bible, and anti-Jesus these days. Could it be their scoffing attitude is encouraged by the anti-Christian, anti-God, anti-Bible, and anti-Jesus brainwashing they're receiving from social media, whether they realize it or not? I think so. And by the way, that was just 20 of the thousands of recent headlines out there showing how biased and anti-Christian social media has really become. You blacklist them and ban them and mock and scoff at their Christian beliefs and their biblical content and media. Again, whatever happened to free speech? Now, for those of you who might even be scoffing at this point thinking there's no way YouTube would ever ban the word Christian, here's the proof. Check it out.
RT News reports. A veterans group in the US claims that YouTube has rejected its ad because it contained the word Christian, something the video sharing platform apparently deemed unacceptable. Chad Robico, the president and founder of the group, gives us his side of the story.
Chad Robichaud, so, we've had different types of censorship in the past, maybe more suppression, but this was the first time that we had an ad denied for a specific keyword Christian, which is a big part of our marketing. We are a faith-based organization that markets to reaching military guys who are struggling with post-traumatic stress, divorce issues, with their military service. We are not a political organization. We do not have a political agenda. We are a faith-based Christian ministry who are trying to reach a particular group of veterans who are struggling.
But not anymore. Google shut you down because you mentioned the word Christian. Can you believe this? In the United States of America, our Christian founding fathers must be rolling over in their graves after all their careful and deliberate attempts to promote Christians' beliefs to ensure our freedoms, which are based out of the Christian Bible. I'll ask it one last time, whatever happened to free speech? But I guess if you subliminally seduce enough people to scoff and mock at the Bible, God, Jesus, and Christianity, then you can trick them into giving up their biblical freedoms and go back to a tyrannical form of government. It's almost like these aliens, I mean rich elites, knew what they were doing from the very beginning when they launched all these global media outlets we've been looking at. Go figure. But as you can see, it's the same sick twisted pattern with all these different forms of global media, including social media. They're all being used to control the narrative and to manipulate the minds of the masses for the elite's own nefarious purposes, and it's going on all over the world, whether you realize it or not. Total manipulation of the minds of the masses, across the whole planet 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just by simply owning and controlling the media called newspapers, radio, music, books, the education system, television, and now even social media. Right now, as we speak, the whole planet is being bombarded by all 7 and there's no escaping it. Or is there? That will be the discussion of our next and final section.